And what we're going to do, members, is we're going to, we'll just do it. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2236, and Jim's going to give us a little rundown. And then I'm going to turn it over to Bill Foster and John Wales from DAS to go through some information about facilities and that sort of thing. And it's all relative to House Bill 2236, so I'm going to just keep the public hearing on it open. So, Jim.
Thanks, sir. House Bill 2236 requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules concerning property rental or leasing rates charged by state agencies that rent or lease property or facilities to other state agencies. Requires department to review rates biannually and report to the Joint Legislative Committee on Ways and Means. We had our first public hearing on January 25th. There is no subsequent referral, no amendments, and I have prepared a large stack of documents for the committee, and it's background information that I put together for this particular bill. The intent is to hopefully have responses to any questions you may have had before the committee meeting, during, and after, and it will also relate to the information that Mr. Foster will be giving us. The first report, the 2000 statewide facility report, I don't know if Bill plans on touching on it or not, but my understanding it has been addressed in some manner through DAS. And then the rest of the information just helps describe all the rules, forms that are used for rental. We have the Powell Evaluation Salem-Kaiser Office and Retail Survey for 2004 to help give a little bit of a comparison of what the private market rates are as they relate to the state. That's it, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bill, John, let me turn it over to you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Foster. I'm the administrator of the Facilities Division of the Department of Administrative Services. And with me is John Wales, the Real Property Services Manager, and Bob Studi, who is a commercial realtor from Portland. Although this hearing pertains to House Bill 2236, we were asked to provide the committee with background information about our role in coordinating, manning, and managing state facility issues.
And Bill, let me interrupt you for just a second. Members, that's that would be the part under which you have informational meeting on your agenda. So we're just kind of combining everything all into one.
So specifically, the areas that we were going to cover was the statewide facility coordination, DAS-owned facilities, private leased office facilities, private office market perspective, local office lease examples, office rental rate comparisons, and agency-to-agency leases and rates. Because we have been asked to share a lot of information, and we also have a special guest from Portland who is time limited, in the interest of making sure we get through the presentation and respect his time, I would ask that the committee hold questions to the end. With that, I would turn the it over to John Wales to go through our presentation.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wales, manager of Real Property Services for the Department of Administrative Services. As Bill indicated, we have a broad range of topics to go through today, and what we wanted to do was to really identify and clarify what the role is for the Facilities Division in Department of Administrative Services in the types of responsibilities that we have. And there are four primary areas that we're going to be focusing on. One is we want to explain our statewide coordination role. We do coordination of statewide facilities planning for about 20 agencies, which encompasses about 14 million square feet of high-value property. And what we mean by high-value are property that is greater than $1 million in replacement value. This function does exclude the university system, however. We also directly provide and manage facility services for roughly 2.3 million square feet of our own DAS-owned building space, including the state office buildings and as well as some specialty buildings. That number excludes the garages that we manage. We provide facility services for roughly 3.9, almost 4 million square feet of the total statewide 14.3 million square feet of office space and specialty space. These are services that are that DAS provides to other agencies that own buildings, such as ODOT, such as Division of State Land. So we provide services to them as well. And in addition, as we talked about the last time, we provide private office leasing services to more than 60 agency boards and commissions. And this is about encompasses about 4 million square feet total. As you can see from the graph, DAS is just one of many 20 agencies that actually own property, and we are a significant player. We are not the largest player, but we are the coordinator of that of the statewide program. In looking at the statewide facility coordination, this is a function that was created back in 1997 when a statute was amended creating the Capital Projects Advisory Board, referred to as CPAB. And the purpose of the board is to review or to give public review to statewide facilities and provide a coordination process for agencies in their facility planning and their maintenance plans. The program was initially established in budget and management, but was transferred to the facilities division back in 1999. The way the Public Lands Advisory Board process works, it is a board that's engaged throughout the biennium. In the odd number years, such as this year, agencies work with our division to update the statewide database, and this is on buildings and facilities that are greater than $1 million in value. So each odd number year, we work with the agencies to update the latest information on what they have, what condition their buildings are in for their high-valued properties, and we go through that exercise. And each even-numbered year, the agency, we coordinate a planning review process with the board where each of the 20 land building-owning agencies submit their property plans on their buildings greater than $1 million in value and their maintenance plans for the coming biennium. They also submit plans for any leased facilities over 25,000 square feet. The way this works is that the agency plans are reviewed and critiqued by the Public Lands Advisory Board prior to submitting agency budgets each biennium. After the plans are reviewed by CPAB, the findings and the evaluations are forwarded to budget and management and to the Legislative Fiscal Office. And this all occurs prior to agencies submitting their budgets in roughly August of each even-numbered year. In 2000, Mr. Keller referenced the draft report that DAS prepared, and this was primarily a document that we used for our internal process to understand the condition of state assets, really the state of the state facilities where we were. This is the first time we'd done a roll-up of our database to see what we had. And there were several significant conclusions that were identified from that report. The first and most obvious is that the state owns and manages a large inventory of real property, and it represents a significant investment in public infrastructure. It's roughly, back in 2000, we roughly had about 12.5 million square feet of high-value building space. Most of the state-owned facilities were located in Salem, providing space for state office workers, which would be on the mall here, as well as patient and inmate residence populations. So that would be the corrections facilities as well as the state hospital, and those compiled the majority of our assets. As you can see from the graph, 42% of our high-value buildings are in Salem, and then the rest are scattered throughout the Portland area and other communities in throughout the state. What was interesting was that about 80% of this high-value space is owned by five agencies. Corrections in the year 2000 had the largest, greatest number, 3.2 million. State hospital had about 1 million square feet. Looking at it a little differently, in the actual number of buildings that each agency had, military came out with the largest number of buildings. This is different from square footage, and Department of Corrections ODOT and Department of Administrative Services. So the number of buildings is a little different order than the actual amount of square footage. What was apparent in that 2000 report was that Oregon's inventory of high-value buildings are becoming increasingly older. The inventory is old. There was a clear need for timely maintenance and repair. And in the database, we really are tracking the condition of roofs, the heating, the ventilation, the air conditioning systems, and the exterior of the buildings. Those are the big ticket items that we want to keep track of and make sure that are being attended to. And that's what the board is looking at in these plans. Although building maintenance costs continue to increase, it's become apparent that the cost of deferred maintenance is generally higher. And that's in some cases that may be pure obvious, but it was a very apparent from the data that we had collected. And we also found that historically agency funding for maintenance repair of state facilities was below what was needed. So there was some work to do. The average building age, as I mentioned, is that the state property is old. You can see that most of the agencies that own have buildings that are in excess of 30 years. The average age of the state hospital and parks and rec are close to 70 years old. So these are older facilities and require maintenance plans. We thought it was interesting to look at the amount of square footage that had been built over time from the 1800s up to the present, and that there had been some cycles in the development process of state buildings that we just didn't build continually. We had a need, a pent-up demand, and then there was usually a surge of development that accommodated that. And we saw that in the 1950s and again in the 1990s, where there was a surge in development. As I mentioned, roofs are a critical maintenance concern, as they're costly to agencies to maintain. But if left unattended, they cause expensive maintenance concerns in other parts of the facility. And we all know in our own houses, when we don't take care of our roofs, other things become problematic. So it does get. And same thing with our office buildings and our facilities. In 2000, and your drafts may say 2002 as a correction I made. This report was in 2000. The state had roughly 8 million square feet of roof space, of which 12% was between 20 and 40 years old. So it was an older inventory that raised our attention and raised the board's attention. And when you looked at that a little closer, we looked at which agency needed roofs that required work and which needed replacement. And so we were starting to collect that information, and that was very helpful for the board to look at a statewide picture and to see where they needed to focus. So that gives you an idea of the statewide role that we play, the coordinating role that we play through the Public Lands Advisory Board. And as I had indicated, that's an ongoing process that works every year. I'm going to now turn the attention to the specific properties that DAS owns and that we manage here in facilities. And as the information that we provided indicate, that DAS provides services for facilities on a cost recovery basis in three ways. There's the uniform rent program, there's self-support rent, and there are service agreements, and I'm going to go through each one of those. Statute already requires us to report proposed rent rates each biennium for these programs. Legislatively approved rents are then posted on the DAS price list for budgetary purposes. So that's in place, and we do that. Looking at uniform rent program, what that program applies to is mostly our office buildings. There are 22 DAS-owned buildings in the uniform rent program. We are going to be bringing the mall houses back into that program this year. It roughly encompasses 1.8 million square feet of office space. And the thing that's important about the uniform rent program and what distinguishes it from others is that all the building and service costs are pooled and equally charge to all agency tenants on a cost per square foot basis. So we take all 22 buildings and all the costs that are associated with them, and they are pooled and divided on a per square foot basis to the agencies that occupy the building. So it's an averaging, and it's a way to keep some equity in the system so that a new building on the mall isn't paying three times what an older building is paid. So that program is a significant part of the work that we manage and undertake. Historically, the uniform rent rates have been increasing over time, as you would imagine, but at a slower rate that we believe than what the private lease market has done. Today, or this biennium, the uniform rent rate is about $1.30 a square foot, and that's a full service rate, and it stays constant for the entire biennium, and that rate will be going up slightly next biennium. Oops, I think I went past one. The self-support rents, these are typically for special purpose buildings. There are 14 self-support rent buildings. You can think of the crime labs, some of the laboratory facilities that the state has built and or renovated for special purposes. And there's approximately 470,000 square feet of this building space. But the thing that's different about the self-support rent is that all the costs for each individual building is charged directly to the tenant. That is, that the tenant is that's occupying the building is paying for the full cost. And generally, they're a single-tenant complexes. In some cases, we have multi-tenants in there. But these are buildings that have been developed for a specific purpose, generally not just office, have a variety of other uses associated with them. So those are not pooled. Those are tenants are charged the direct cost for those facilities. And then the third area that we recover our costs is in our service agreements. We provide facility support services at cost to tenants in other agency buildings, such as in the ODOT building or in the state lands building, where they own the building, but we would provide facility services to them, and those are done on contract and on a cost per square foot basis. We also charge agencies for specific costs above the standard service in our own uniform rent buildings if an agency has specific requirements above and beyond what the standard service would be. They would be charged that difference. And an example is a maintenance of some of the computer equipment, tenant-owned equipment in certain buildings that we would maintain for them. And just to round out the picture again, most unsurprisingly, most of our properties that DAS owns is in Salem. 78% of our DAS owned buildings here on the Capitol Mall and around the mall is where we're primarily located. We do have some space in Portland, the state office building, the Albina building, and then some smaller facilities around the state as well. If I could turn the subject to our leasing program from private landlords, and this is where we wear the different hat. Where I've been talking about is where we've been the landlord and leasing to other agencies. Now we are the tenant, and we are leasing from private landlords. And there, as I mentioned, there are about 60 agencies that we do this for, representing about 4 million square feet of office space on behalf of state agencies. We don't lease on behalf generally of the university system or OHSU or some of the semi-independent boards. We have roughly 600 leases that DAS negotiates on behalf of the agencies, and about 250 of these each year either are up for renewal, require amendments, or just require termination and new leases are needed. And so we have a small leasing group that manages this in the division. Our leasing locations are a little different. We're spread more evenly. We've got about 30% in Salem, about 30% in the Portland area, and then scattered around. And there's a reason for that, is that a lot of our leases are for agencies such as the Department of Human Services, who need locations close to client bases. And so they're more targeted to communities and to meet client populations, and employment is the same way. When we look at our the location of our leasing, our lease facility, as well as our state-owned facilities, there are some guiding principles that are stated in our policy and how we do that. The first one, we're given a challenge to identify space, is that we first look to see if there is state-owned space that's available, and if there is, we would try to locate them there. If not, we look to co-locate with local government offices, and we're always looking at finding a location that meets the operational needs of the agency served. We are concerned about meeting the community's existing infrastructure, and that is, we don't like to locate a facility that's going to cause the city to extend its water or sewer lines or rezone property that we work within the structure of what the city has designated as usable space for this type of commercial use. And that's what we mean by we locate in target areas, and these are areas that are designated for the commercial types of uses that that the cities have approved. And that could be in a downtown, or it could be in a designated area in another part of the community. And so those are the areas that we try to target. We're also concerned about locating with access to the public pedestrian access, as well as to public transit. And at the end of the day, we want to make sure that whatever transaction we do has the best overall value for the state and the communities that we're located in. So those are our guiding principles in our state policy on how we locate facilities. I think what we'll do is invite Bob Studi, who is the principal at Norris & Stevens. He's the president of commercial services. We received several questions from the committee in the past few weeks requesting that somebody, a professional from the real estate community, come and speak with you. And Mr. Studi has graciously accepted. He has been serving for 8 years on the Public Lands Advisory Committee, which is another committee that advises DAS on our public lands, and he has a very good handle on the knowledge of the market in the private sector. So with that, Bob?
Representative Crummell, members of the committee, my name is Bob Studi, and I am with a commercial real estate firm, Norris & Stevens, in Portland. I am a principal of the corporation, and let me give you a brief description of our firm. We were established in 1967. We are one of the leading commercial real estate firms in the city of Portland, and actually in the state of Oregon and in Southwest Washington. We employ about 75 people in-house. We have an office in the American Bank Building across from Pioneer Square in downtown Portland. And we do a significant amount of management, manage about 8,000 apartment units and about 8 million square feet of commercial space in the Portland metropolitan area. And we have a brokerage group of about 25 brokers who do leasing and sales primarily in the Portland metropolitan area. However, we also manage a lot of apartments in Salem, down to Eugene. We manage some shopping centers down here in Salem, and through affiliations do brokerage around the country. One of the things we're doing right now is representing McCormick and Schmick's in some locations in Washington, D.C., in places like this. So we reach out in different directions and have a lot of experience in working in commercial real estate, although the Portland market is a bit different than San Francisco, Seattle, and various cities. It's interesting to visit these cities and see the dynamics that are involved. Let me get to the questions that have been asked, and one of those is the Portland office market perspective and the size of the Portland market. We subscribe to a national real estate data service. Virtually all the brokers in the Portland metropolitan area belong to this group called CoStar, and it tracks all the office space in the marketplace, and that Portland metropolitan area, which also includes Vancouver, Washington, comprises about 61 million square feet of office space, just office space. And that includes about 2,063 buildings, of which about 121 of those are owner-occupied buildings. And they track these buildings on a monthly basis for vacancies, occupancies, absorption. And so we have pretty good statistics that we can track from month to month of how the market is doing. An overall, kind of an overall overview, if you will, of the Portland area market. The last statistics that I had were for the fourth quarter of 2004. So the first quarter of 2005 is not completed yet, and so it'll be interesting to see how those come out. But as of the fourth quarter, the vacancies had decreased in the fourth quarter to about 13.9%. And again, remember, this is just office space, not retail, not industrial. Previously, it had been at 14.5% at the end of the third quarter of 2004 and 16% for the first quarter of 2004. So the vacancies were coming down slightly, which is, of course, good news. Net absorption, which is one of the statistics that we all watch very carefully, and this is the amount of new space being leased in the marketplace, not just one tenant moving from one building to another building, but net absorption. That was 533,000 for the fourth quarter of 2004, which is good news. It's, again, not dynamic, but certainly good news. It bodes well for our market, and I think it'd be fair to say from all this that we bottomed out and we're now on our way up, and I'll talk a little more about that as we get into this. Vacant sublease space decreased to 686,000 square feet. And of course, you can talk about vacancy factors in a market, but the vacancy factor of the building vacancy often does not include the sublease factor. And so these statistics can be very, very misleading. You can have a market that might be 5% vacant, but you've got another 15% of sublease space out there that's available. And eventually, that will become building vacancy if you're not in a robust market. The rental rates increased in the fourth quarter to an average of $17.44 per square foot per year. So you divide by 12 to compare that with the monthly. And please understand that that is a very gross number because it includes all classes of space. We, for instance, in our office space leasing and in our management, we do probably more of the leasing and sales and management of the older remodeled downtown buildings than any other company in the market. And I would say that I see rental rates on a full service basis going anywhere from $12 a square foot a year, so a dollar a foot a month, up to maybe as high as $24 a square foot a year, so that's $2 a square foot a month. And so this average, you've got to be very careful to say that, to compare that with exactly what you're doing. It's very misleading. Now, while the above indications that I just quoted are positive, the market is not what we would refer to as dynamic. The economics of Oregon right now are a bit suspect, and we're going to wait with bated breath to see how all this rolls out here in the near future. We've had one good quarter after about three kind of dismal quarters, and we're all being very positive about it, but there's a huge number of things that affect this economy, as you well know. I think there is driving forces in the marketplace which include general optimism and positive indicators, including the national and state employment increases. One of the dynamics that has been very puzzling to many of us have, in the marketplace, has been that we've had a lot of new population coming into the market. However, we've not been able to create jobs for these people, so we've had this very high unemployment level. But it's misleading because we may have been creating jobs, but just not enough to take care of all this new population coming in. And then there's other dynamics that are in the marketplace that are much different than what we've experienced before because of these very low interest rates. We find people in the buildings going out and buying their own buildings. They're finding that their debt service can be competitive with the rental rates that they were paying before when they were leasing space. Or we see that in the housing market where tenants are going out and buying houses as opposed to staying in their rental units, and we're experiencing record high vacancies in the rental units. We've probably got as bad as about 10% vacant, which is unheard of in our apartment market. So interesting dynamics, a lot driven by the increasing population, not able to create enough jobs for all these people, and these record low interest rates, unbelievably low interest rates. And while we have sort of a dismal leasing market and occupancy in some of these properties, or have had, at the same time we're having record investment sales. There is so much money in our marketplace chasing investment properties. It's just unbelievable. And we don't have a corner on that market in Portland, Oregon. It's all across the United States. Money fleeing the stock market, going into commercial real estate. One of the questions on here had to do with the market, the class of property. A, B, C are typically used as classes of office buildings. And it's a bit misleading and good lines of demarcation between all of these, but let me just generally describe. A Class A property would be an extremely desirable property, which would command the highest rentals. It would be well located. It would have efficient layouts, modern mechanical systems and maintenance. And typically, these are new properties, and again, they're in the very best of locations. And to give you an idea of what I mean by efficiency, if you take the older buildings, they typically had less space between column widths than the newer buildings, and so you lose efficiencies when you're doing this. New buildings will have window walls right to the floor, as opposed to having air conditioning units and that sit out and take up a foot or a foot and a half of the space. Better designs, and of course that saves money to a large office space user. A Class B building, in comparison, would be a lower priced compared to the A building. It would lack special amenities or location. It wouldn't have quite as good a maintenance and mechanical. It would lack the prestige, and these buildings are oftentimes 10 to 20 years old and sometimes more, depending on how they're maintained. A Class C building, and Class C can oftentimes include the historic properties also. These are usually older buildings, lower rents, not prestigious, average maintenance and location. Now, it should be noted that when you're talking about these classes of buildings, oftentimes it will come down to the perception of the person who's measuring the class. If you're the seller of the building, you, of course, always believe your building is an A-class building. If you're the buyer, then it's about a D-class building. So a lot of crossover. But if you're in Portland, for instance, the Fox Tower would be Mr. Moyer's Fox Tower at Southwest Broadway and Yamhill would be an example of an A-class property. Probably the U.S. Bank Plaza would be an A-class property. Wells Fargo Tower, because of its size, would be an A-class property, even though that's an older property. C-class properties would be a lot of the older remodeled buildings, like the Morgan Building. And now the American Bank Building that we're in, because of its stature, might be pushing the B-class property. But there's, again, these ratings will overlap, depending on who's talking about them. Now, those factors that will come into play in deciding the class would be certainly age, location, demand in the marketplace, curb appeal, the mechanical systems, the efficiency, the parking, the additional facilities such as conference rooms, workout rooms. Used to be years ago when I got in the business that you measured the better buildings by how big the law library was. Well, now the law library is a postage stamp almost because of the computerization. You don't have those. The buildings actually stocked those law libraries, and they would be very huge, and that, of course, would attract the very best law firms, and that no longer is a classification or a amenity that people are looking for. Now, the cost factors in setting the private sector rates. Typically, when a property is originally constructed or purchased, a new purchaser, there would be typically what we call a pro forma income and expense study, and that's kind of like on paper, and this is what it ought to be. And it's much like what you would do with an appraisal on an office building or a house or anything else, where you compare the market statistics and the other comparable properties with what your own property should be, and that would be your maybe your budget, maybe your goals for where you want to go with this property. This study usually compares the rents and the operating expenses of the new property, whether it's a brand new property or whether it's a just purchased property, with existing properties. It's much like an appraiser would use in studying comparable properties and assign a value to the subject property. Now, the market factors in setting the lease rate would be a little bit different. You can have all these things hypothetically on a piece of paper, and that's where you want to go with your lease rates and with your operating costs. However, it is hypothetical, and the property needs to lease in the current market conditions. And if you've got a nice building where you've done a pro forma showing a 5% vacancy factor with rental rates that might be at $20 a square foot, and you're in a market with 30% vacancy in your sub-market, you have to get out there and compete. You've got to do deals that are going to compete, and I don't care what's written on that piece of paper. That pro forma goes out the window, and you've got to make deals. And you try to structure those transactions in a manner that will maybe bring you out down the line. For instance, some investors might be interested in giving away some free rent at the front end or more tenant improvements in order to achieve a higher rental down the line, and they'll stagger those rents as they go. But again, you've got to look at what is the effective rent as opposed to what those staggered rents are. Very, very confusing and misleading unless you really do analyze all of these things. And these market conditions will be heavily influenced by supply and demand, no doubt about that. There will often be incentives as delayed commencement date, above standard tenant improvements, free parking, free rent, other offers that are made to attract tenants. When I talked about the average rental rate in the Portland market of $17.44 a square foot, that's typically what we would call the face rate on the lease. That does not get into how many months of free rent were given. If normal tenant improvements are $10 a square foot and they ended up building in a firm of attorneys, for instance, with a lot of offices, they could easily spend $30 a square foot, or in a doctor's office, they could spend $40 to $50 a square foot, or in a restaurant, maybe even $200 a foot. And so those often will not be reflected in that rental rate. So once again, to take that $17.44 and say this is the average and compare that, it can be very misleading. You've got to be careful of that. John and Bill gave me some questions about our own firm and experiences that we've had with state agencies. First question was, does your firm have experience leasing to state agencies or public entities? Well, we do some leasing and have over the years, and I can't say that we're doing a tremendous amount of this at the present time. I don't believe that any of the state or federal agencies or county agencies have been in the market to any great degree in the last couple, 3 years. I think we've all been kind of hunkering down, as you can see by the statistics that I quoted. The second question was, how does placing a public body differ from tenants in the private sector? You know, I think it's, from my perception, it's mostly the same. I don't think there's, typically if the state comes, they want to use their own lease form, or if the federal GSA comes, they want to use their own lease form. The feds have a little different method of measuring floor space, which I believe is under analysis right now and may be brought into more in keeping with what we call the BOMA, Building Owners and Managers Association standards. And BOMA does have some very specific standards, and I believe that the state uses those. I'm not entirely sure of that, but it is the national standard for measuring space. My only recollection of anything that might be at all different, well, a couple things. One is that the state typically pays the rent in the month following the activity month, which is interesting. But everybody's used to it. It's been that way for years and years and years, and it's kind of like, again, a non-event anymore. In management, we always see the state of Oregon delinquent in the activity month, and we're going, well, what's that about? And then we recall that they are the one tenant who pays the next month. Which is good for the state. Good job, John. I can also recollect that when we're building in tenants, the issues like the handicap, ADA accessibility is very, very important to them. Everything has to be just so. And not surprisingly, they have a lot of the handicapped groups who are looking over their shoulders to make sure that that drinking fountain is just so many inches off the floor. And, so that becomes something that is a factor. But again, it's not, it's certainly not anything that anybody should be ashamed of or concerned about. I think that when the state's out in the marketplace, they are, it's seamless. It's much like any other tenant. Do you actively seek state agencies, tenants, or are you indifferent? Why? I guess indifferent. We get requests for proposals from time to time from the states and the feds and Multnomah County and these sorts of people, all these different agencies, and we'll certainly run with those if we have a property that's available. Usually they want you to be either the listing agent or to have authority from the owner of the property so that an agent doesn't get that request for proposal, and then he goes out and tries to represent the state in all the buildings. That can't happen, and that's good. That's, I was telling Valerie McBride here that years ago when I was involved as a young leasing agent back in the 70s, they had a different sort of a program, and the state, well, first of all, as a young broker, I always appreciated the fact that when there was a new administration in the state, they either wanted to centralize everything because they could always serve their clients better, or they wanted to decentralize. And so every time there was a new administration, it was a wonderful opportunity for a new leasing agent, for a young leasing agent like me, because you knew that there was, we were going to be decentralizing or centralizing, and so we'd be out there looking for space for them. And if you did a good job for a particular agency, you oftentimes would get the nod from that agency, and you'd be the broker that would be the favorite one. Now, you had to work hard, but that was, some would view that as perhaps not being fair, and I think the process that you have today with the request for proposals is much fairer, gets the word out to everybody, and certainly serves the state's interest better. Although, as a young leasing agent, I really did appreciate those, you know, large state deals that we did. And that's a long time ago. Are there changes that the state could make that would make it easier, more efficient, and hopefully less expensive for the state to find necessary office space? I'm not aware of anything that's that the state does in particular. I know the federal government is more inclined to be in the very A-class properties because of code issues and access and this sort of thing. I don't believe that, from my experience, I don't think the state is quite as animate about that, and that you look at more across-the-board type of properties. The federal government, by virtue of the standards that they have, and you could always look into those and compare them, but I think they'll typically end up with the very highest of rentals because of that attitude. I don't think it's exactly prudent. And I think the state does fine. I think they... And I haven't heard any comments negatively in the marketplace through our associations or anything like that. So I think they're doing a lot of things absolutely correctly. I think that concludes my remarks, and I would say that we have access to a lot of statistics if you, by virtue of this CoStar group that we belong to, if you want amount of office space in particular submarkets. You know, we track submarkets like downtown, close in east side, Tigard, Wilsonville, and different places like this, so we can get more pertinent statistics, including absorption, rental rates, size of the market in these particular areas, if anybody does need those. More than happy to help.
Thank you.
That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Bob. Maybe I could just quickly go through the rest of the slides, or did you want to ask?
Well, I just want to make sure. I thought I heard Bill say that Bob's time was kind of limited.
Yeah, I do need to get back on the road.
And so if I might go ahead and interrupt here to see if there's any questions for Bob. Members, do you have any questions for Mr. Studi? I think when you were talking about the class of the building, so what I got from what you were saying is that the class of the building is dependent on the age and the condition and that sort of thing, and it's not necessary, and it's not based on the style. So a Class A building, for example, like the Revenue Building, which is a fairly new building here in Salem, but it's, you know, your basic office space, and it's what, seven stories or something? Bill or John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's something like five stories, okay? But it's something like that. But because of its newness and so all the mechanical systems and so on and so forth, that would be considered a Class A building. But the ODOT building, which is basically the same style of building, I mean, it's, you know, straight up and it's five or six stories, but its condition is not as good. It's some of its systems are failing. Some other points about it, that may actually be a Class C building, even though they're the same style of building.
Yeah. No, I don't think that style would be irrelevant. I think you might have an architect who brought some certain style to the marketplace. I think of the Portland building that was designed by Caskey. That may have been a C class when it was built downtown. That design was a bit suspect, and I don't think anybody would have ever called that an A class building in downtown Portland. It's where the Portlandia sculpture was, and
right.
A lot of the county and city office spaces were in it.
What do you mean, was? Isn't Portlandia still there?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that thing moved here.
So I think style does have something to do with it, and architecture does have something to do with it. But again, these the classes will overlap each other. There could be a number of people that could say that the Wells Fargo Tower, which is second highest building in the city of Portland, might be a B-class building because of its age and not as efficient as the newer Fox Tower, for instance. There'd be no question that Fox Tower would be an A-class building. And there will be some buildings that stand the test of time better than others. They were built with better materials. You take a building like the old Crown Plaza down on Market First, I believe it is, and the state, I believe, used to have agencies in there. I don't know whether they do today, but that was all concrete exterior painted. Well, it just wasn't, we're not putting good materials on the outside like travertine or a good metal fascia and that sort of thing, and it won't stand the test of time as well. That's certainly no more than a B-class building today, in my opinion. Now, the owner of the building might disagree with that.
And, of course, the maintenance has a lot to do with it, too. I think there will be some buildings where they might have an A-class exterior, but the inside is not being maintained at all, and the carpets are becoming threadbare, and janitorial services are not up to, and they may be perceived as a class lower because of the way that the property is being taken care of or managed. Some buildings that might be towards a B-class alternative may have concierge services that are available in the lobby and guard service and that sort of thing, which could tend to elevate them higher. So it's misleading, sir.
Is the class then more related to, well, let me phrase it a different way, because I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, so even in a downtown area, but mostly out in the suburban areas, you know, Beaverton, Wilsonville, Tualatin, those sorts of areas, you find buildings that are laid out in sort of a campus style. For example, they most of the offices have outside entrances into them. I wouldn't call them a strip mall, but they're, you know, because they might be built in clusters where you walk into a common area and there might be, you know, an office here, an office here, and an office here type of, so in a triplex type of, but that would that be you know, that versus a three or four or five story building, would that be considered a different class because of its style, or could that still be a Class A building?
Well, I think the class is going to be influenced by that submarket. If you go to Wilsonville, you're not going to find any 40 story towers, and
right,
you're going to find that most everything is campus style. And so then I think all that green space and the amenities that are available in there, the parking levels, the newness of the property, could very easily cause that to be an A-class property. Whereas you could have a similar campus-style property down the street, again, wasn't maintained, the grass is too long, and they're not edging properly, and not maintaining it, but it could be a C-class property again.
Okay.
But an A-class property in downtown is not going to be the same as an A-class property out in a submarket like Wilsonville or perhaps Gresham and places like this. I don't think there is much in Wilsonville that's over. I can only think of a few buildings that might be over two floors in the Wilsonville market.
Yeah, there's not very many of them, that's for sure.
That's right.
That's, yeah. Let's see, I just wanted to see if there was anything else here that I don't think so. Mr. Studi, I really appreciate you coming down. Are there any other questions for okay. Really appreciate you making the trek down from Portland to
help, and if there's any additional information that we can get for you, we'd be more than happy to talk.
Great. Thank
you.
I do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
John? Bill, thank you.
Okay, John, go ahead and continue on.
We just have a few more slides, and then we can certainly open it up for questions. There were several questions from the committee about some of the specific leases that we had here in Salem, and we just want to give you a kind of an overview. But first, from our leasing database, we want to give you a perspective that in the Salem market, the average cost for a full-service lease, that would be all costs in, is roughly $1.35 a square foot. The Portland market's a little bit higher, $1.49 per square foot, and Eugene market is one of the more expensive markets for us, and just that it's there are fewer opportunities. It's a limited supply there, and that is $1.50. And I should caution that these are average square foot rates at the time the leases were executed. Over time, as the operating costs, the utilities, taxes go up, they get adjusted upward a little bit. But these are the average, give you an idea of where we all fit into the to the market. As far as A, B, and C, we typically are in B and C buildings. There are a few A building, Class A buildings that we would be in, but those are pretty more rare than more the exception than the rule. One of the examples of the lease here in Salem is a 21,000, almost 22,000 square foot facility. It's the Building Codes Division over in the Oak Hills Mall, West Salem. That was a lease that began back in July 1997. It was a 10-year lease. It ends in June of 2007. It's a very favorable rate at $1.22 per square foot for the state. Operating expenses are reconciled annually, and we've got 2-year extension options in between. That was a property that, under today's rules, since it's over 10,000 square feet, we would go out with an RFP for, and it would be a competitive process in locating a facility of that size. Fish and Wildlife at the other extreme is part of the largest facility that we've located here in Salem. When we were asked to relocate them to Salem from Portland, there wasn't an existing, or there weren't many existing buildings of 72,000 square feet in the Salem market. I think there were about 3 that could accommodate this. And again, that was done through a competitive process. And we were fortunate in able to negotiate an aggressive lease rate of $1.48 a square foot on that building. And that's got, it's a 5-year term, as I recall, with options to extend. The long-term plan, of course, is to bring them into owned space. And we're evaluating when and where we're going to be able to do that. And then another example, this one at 22,000 square feet, the Workers' Compensation Board, and that's over on the east side of the city. Again, it's this lease actually just started in November and goes to 2009. $1.33 square foot is the full service rate for that facility. So that gives you an idea of what the types of properties and the rates that we get here in Salem. One thing we thought would be helpful and what the committee had asked for was to, how do you compare all of this? How do you look at how a lease is structured in the private sector, and how do you compare that to how we structure our rates for the uniform rent program and for the self-support program? And so we put together a chart to try to explain this, but it's important in looking at the lease rate for when we go into the market to when we rent from a private landlord or from our DAS-owned buildings, that the construction of the lease rates are very similar. They differ in terms of which costs are fixed and which ones are variable. And so what we're really going to be showing you is that the risk is different. And it really, leasing and structuring lease rates is all about managing risk. Private lease rates are generally have fewer fixed landlord costs and more variable costs for the agency or the tenant that occupies them. In our own buildings, we require a rate structure that DAS, as the landlord, takes more of the risk and fixes costs for a 2-year period without variation, providing more certainty for agencies. And those are some of the big differences. So in your packages, you'll see a table where we laid out a typical the typical components and of what goes into building a lease rate. There's the debt, there's the maintenance costs, the utility costs. And in a industry triple net lease, which would be where the first column here, you can see the shaded areas are the areas that the landlord would be fixed. The areas that are unshaded represent the areas that the agency would be paying for directly and would be variable. The second column shows the type of leases Mr. Studi described that we at the state have with the private sector when we're the tenant in a private building. The shaded areas are the areas that are the costs that the landlord would be committing to. There may be some escalation over a period of time, but pretty much those costs and the unshaded costs are the ones that the state agency would be required to pay directly, either through true-ups at the end of the year on certain operating costs or whatever formula was required. So most of our leases as tenants in private from private landlords are in that second column, look like that second column. It's that kind of structure. When you take this criteria and put it against the DAS owned space, it's a little different. There's more shading, and so what we're really doing here is now trading hats. These graphs or this table reflects when we are the landlord providing space to other state agencies, and you can see in the uniform rent program, DAS is committing to all these costs over a 2-year period. We're committing to a little bit more in the self-support rent, and that probably is the biggest difference for a tenant in a DAS building, in that they are guaranteed a rate for the biennium, and that's the reason that we go through the process of identifying these costs, bringing them to the legislature in our uniform rent program, and then putting them in the price list so agencies can budget for that. But at that, we were trying to figure out a way graphically to demonstrate how can you compare the private and the state-owned space, and that was the intent of this graphic. The bill that we're here to discuss requires that DAS adopt rules concerning property rental or leasing rates charged by state agencies that rent or lease property to facilities other than state agencies. As we've indicated, statute already requires DAS to report uniform rent rates each biennium, and legislatively approved rents then get posted on our on the DAS price list to budget. So from where for the properties that we manage, we go through this every biennium and explain that. If we're looking at other agencies that lease to other agencies, ODOT leasing to employment or in their own buildings, there aren't many of those leases. We've got roughly seven in our database where we would represent the agency that was going to be the tenant. And there are a few in veterans building, state lands building. They lease to Employment and Economic Development. And the Department of Education leases to the Blind Commission, but there are not many leases where a state agency that's not in a DAS building, a non-DAS agency is leasing to other state agencies. But this is what we've got as an example of our in that arena. So with that, I think that concludes our slide presentation remarks, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Are there questions for either Bill or John?
I actually have one.
Representative Dinkfeld.
And I apologize. I had a hearing on one of my bills this morning, so I've been here since 6:30. I do have a question, and I've just been flipping through your slides here. As far as the facilities that we own, and I've talked to Department of Energy about this, can you talk about the cost savings that we are realizing because of the energy efficiencies that we're implementing in our own buildings? And do you keep track of that in addition to the Department of Energy? And you know, can you see other ways that we can save money on either water conservation? You know, I know you're working on lighting fixtures, heating, those types of things that in our own buildings where we have a little more control in buildings we lease. Maybe you can explain for the committee what you've been doing on that and what kind of cost savings we're realizing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, we have a program where we're collecting that data, and then we provide it to the Department of Energy. At this point in time, There was a bill that passed that required that all state agencies needed to achieve a savings above the 2000 base rate of 10%. And pretty much across the board, most of the agencies are doing that or exceeding. There's a few outliers. But there's a pretty good program in place to look at what we can do. And it is something that takes constant vigilance. Because in the past, when we've kind of let down our guard about looking at those energy costs, all of a sudden they start to escalate. So I think we have institutionalized a fairly good process that allows us to keep track of that, and you know, but it also means we have to constantly look at opportunities. And as new technology comes along, one of the areas that has been huge is lighting. And you know, when we see that we can do a cost-effective project, we will, you know, try to do that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And so that's information that you can bring back to this committee or provide to me. You know, I think it would be of interest to the committee to hear about the savings that we can realize. I know that it takes staff to do this, but hopefully in the long run we're going to have a much bigger payback than what we're investing up front, especially for the amount of facilities that we own. Question I have, you said it was savings of above a 10% base rate. Do we have any type of standards, in other words, And I'm just not that familiar with this aspect of the law. I'm familiar with the Senate, the Senate bill with the public purposes, which we're going to hear on Thursday, which works more with schools and other facilities. But do we have standards that increase over time for buildings? I mean, you know, saying we're meeting a base rate is one thing, but setting higher standards as new technologies come online, is that something that we currently have on the books or something we may want to look at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, no, at this point in time, there really is an escalation. It was trying to get that in place and to get to a certain level. Now, then there's a companion piece on new buildings, and that is 20% above code.
For new buildings?
Yes. But it could be that there's some room there that could be explored. However, you know, it's one of those things where we really want to look at the cost effectiveness of the particular measures that are being proposed and make sure that you know, they have reasonable paybacks and are not just simply saving energy but costing, you know, offsetting costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Other questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Capital Projects Advisory Board, are they up to staff with seven members?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, yes, they are.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Butler.
There are five private or public members on that advisory.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, it's a mix. We just changed the composition slightly, and there are now two members from the City of Salem off of their staff, one from the Public Works and the other one from the planning area. And the others are people that have some fairly long experiences and lots of background in facilities and come from a variety of places. One is works with the Northwest Natural Gas. Another is a former school district facilities manager. Another is a retired higher ed person that was in the chancellor's office. So, you know, it's a good range of folks with a lot of experience.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, the concern is that the public members, it talks about two being state employees or public employees, and the rest of them knowledgeable in construction, facilities management, maintenance issues, and it sounds like you've met that. In consultation with the board, the director would request that agencies submit updated long-range facilities plans, funding strategies. I assume that's done on a regular basis so that we have a pretty good long-term vision of where we're going.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's correct. And just a point of clarification, The membership of the board, it says, may have two state employees.
Yes.
We have not had two state employees on it. It has all been outside people.
Okay. And then, with, if I may, Mr. Chair,
follow up. Sure.
It also indicates the department shall establish and maintain a database of information on all state-owned property and all of all state agencies, including lands, buildings, infrastructures, improvements, leases. In that inventory, and I assume that we have that inventory, I think I've seen it before produced, do we have the actual, including the vacant lands that may be owned by ODOT, do we have the costs of these various parcels that it costs us to maintain the parcels? I realize some of those have come from dedicated ODOT funds.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we kind of are a little bit divided in how we handle that. There is a certain amount of roll-up into the database that you're describing under the Capital Projects Advisory Board. The other side is our really our public lands, and maybe John can better address what is exactly in there and how we're managing it. There are some issues about how much and how current we can be about values and costs and those kinds of things. So there really isn't a whole lot of that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not concerned about values. I am concerned about them, but I'm not concerned about values as much as I am the costs of maintaining vacant lands. This is an issue more in rural portions of the state, I'm going to guess, than it is here in the metropolitan area, but I am concerned about any kinds of funds that are going to maintain lands which are not mm-hmm. projected to be needed mm-hmm. in the agency's long-term program. I mean, certainly I can see the issue of maintaining additional right-of-way frontage along fast-growing thoroughfares. But I guess, you know, a block of land in one part or another of the state that's condemned and is excess once the construction is finished, that's a concern. And I guess I'm not interested in identifying, again, the fair market value as much as I am the cost of maintaining it, the cost of cleaning it, the cost of insuring it, because we are self-insured with regard to the risk management, as you know, Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think this is one of the things that some of the dilemma about trying to better manage this whole portfolio, because some of those same lands, it ends up that the cost of really attempting to market them exceed the value. So you're kind of a catch-22, and maybe John can add a little to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, what exists now are two databases, and they're up until recently been managed separately. The facilities database tracks all the costs and of all the buildings and their maintenance plans and the costs associated with all of those, and those are where the major costs are. The lands inventory, which you're describing, is a much higher roll up. At our agency level, we're basically tracking where the property is, who owns it, where what's it used for, and at that level, you'd have to drill down to the agency's more individual land budgets just to get a portfolio of what the cost is for maintaining that. Now, these are databases really supply information to two different boards. The facilities database supplies information to the Public Lands Advisory Board, the CPAB that we talked about here. The lands inventory at this point is being reviewed and data goes to the Public Lands Advisory Committee. That's a separate committee. And they're looking at more of the overview of what the state has and what the what the strategy is of agencies to retain land, identify land they don't need, and to go forward and surplus. Those are the kinds of issues that they're dealing with. Our goal would be to merge these databases together so that we would have a complete inventory and to put it into a geographic information system, a GIS base. But that's coming in ahead. But we now control within the facilities within the facilities division both databases, but historically they've been separate because they have been used separately by different boards.
Mr. Chair, I just call your attention to this. The statute that provides that it isn't the goal to do it. It says that you shall establish and maintain a simple database of information of state-owned property of all state agencies, including land, building, and infrastructures. And I guess the process of dancing through the hoops that you've just explained about the Public Lands Advisory and these other groups is probably the reason why it's so difficult to identify much of this and then to determine what is truly excess, because it's my understanding that we do this, and I appreciate what the comment is, that Jimmy, to value this and to dispose of it would cost as much as the land. But if we were to value it and dispose of it and put it back into private hands, those lands could be yielding property taxes, which would then fund schools and would fund some of the kinds of things, and the excess we would receive off of those lands could go back in towards the common school fund as well, if in fact they are public lands. So I'm anxious about a process. I know that it takes, when my constituents have a 20-foot narrow neck or a 5-acre piece of land that's left over as a remnant from these kinds of construction activities, it takes virtually years. And I'm not talking about two or three, I'm talking about decades of time for that to get back onto the public rolls. And any monies that are used to maintain that, I submit, are wasted monies. And I know that ODOT and other agencies have rather significant budgets to maintain these. But as I read the statutes, it appears.
Representative, what statute are you referring to there, if you don't mind?
You bet. It's the ORS 276.227, and it's the statute that's referred to under the CPAB, the Capital Plan Projects Advisory Board, as to giving them the authority and giving them the responsibility to be able to supervise it. And I guess, Mr. Chair, that moving these into various categories as to who owns them, it's my understanding that the only reason that we should be maintaining those pieces of land would be if they became part of the plan that's provided for, where the director, in consultation with the board, may request the agency submit the updated long-range facility plans and funding strategies to reflect what you're going to be doing with these properties. So that's my concern, and I guess if there was a way that we could assure that this wouldn't take a long time to do this, that I'm anxious, because much of this land has sat idle and creates. I live in a district that's got a freeway running through from north to south, about half my district. And that doesn't sound like a big deal when you live around freeways, in the districts represented here. Yeah, we thought we were big time when we got a freeway running through part of the town. But I guess the concern I've got is that, particularly where these excess remnants are left virtually in debris and rubble for years and years and years, it creates a hazard, which is a risk management issue. It creates a nuisance, which is an economic development issue, and then you're not going to get the highest and best price out of the land at a later time. So I just would like to know that there would be some process, and I don't know, there probably is a process. I think we've looked at it before in statute that says these lands which are excess if they cannot be identified by the board to be truly lands that we're going to build on or we're going to expand to or progress and grow on, then they should be declared excess and we should get them back on the property tax rolls, moving the capital proceeds therefrom back into the common school fund.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, just a quick follow-up on this. I think, the Capital Projects Advisory Board has some statutory definitions there, but really it's more of the Public Lands Advisory Board that really has this responsibility under Chapter 270. And there is a committee that is there that works with us on this that includes Representative Gilman and Senator Winters now on that board. So I think what we're trying to do is work with them, and ODOT is one that particularly has a large inventory and is trying to work at moving it in a better way. And maybe John can kind of go more to that.
Yes, the Public Lands Advisory Committee has taken on this year, starting last year, the role of reviewing all the agencies' inventory, getting reports from the agencies, and to understand how agencies make decisions that property is needed and how they make decisions that property is no longer needed. And then once they make that decision of the property that's no longer needed, what is their process in getting it into the market and back on the tax rolls? We've heard from ODOT, we've heard from Division of State Lands, heard from Department of Forestry. In April, they'll be hearing from Fish and Wildlife. And so they're starting to get a pattern, and every agency is a little different in terms of how it works. But what the hope is here that there will be some themes and some recommendations that will come out on how we can better monitor this and address what kind of resources are needed. I mean, ODOT literally has thousands and thousands of these parcels that Representative Butler's referring to. And their strategy right now is to address the ones of the highest value and to get those back into the market first. But they've got a whole process that they go through. So the board is actively looking at this issue as one they're concerned about, and at each meeting they're getting a different presentation from one of the larger landowning agencies just to address this issue.
Okay. I can tell you from my district, I represent that there's one particular little piece of property that ODOT owns next to Highway 99, and they have offered to sell it to the adjacent property owner, but the price is so steep that the adjacent property owner is basically telling the state to keep the property themselves.
But maintain it.
Because they're sick and tired of the property
Mr. Chair, that therein lies the problem.
If they're
going to stick a price on it, and much of this is landlocked. Let's face it, much of it's landlocked. And I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem if ODOT wants to expand its fences out to include that, and then bring it into its own beautification program, so that they're maintaining the park next to the highway, because that's what it becomes. My concern is that when they abandon it and then leave it as an eyesore and a junk pile, much of it to accumulate debris, and then put a price tag on it that's higher than a cat's back, and you can't, you just can't afford to keep it, and you can't afford. Mr. Chair, I just am very anxious about the kinds of things that you've got in your district that basically it sends the wrong message. And that message is we draw, in state agencies, we draw our money from a well that never runs dry. And I actually had, years ago, a state person tell me from ODOT that they drew their money from a well that never runs dry. So don't talk to them about their excess lands. And that probably more than any single issue is probably what drove my desires to come and see where this well existed somewhere here in Salem.
The Highway Trust Fund.
You wanted to find it.
I have a question that is a little tangent to what we're talking about here, but what do we do, and Representative Butler may not like that I'm asking this question, but I do know, for instance, the Division of State Land oversees leases for state lands that, you know, we lease, similar to the federal government, where we lease out to private entities that lease our land for grazing or whatever purposes. What do we do to review the rates that are being charged by state agencies to private individuals, not other state agencies, to make sure that it's fair market value? And, you know, I sit on Ways and Means Natural Resources, where we look at how we can try to replace common school fund money, which, you know, Division of State Lands is currently drawing off of. And one of my pet peeves, since we're on pet peeves here, is that we don't, you know, we're subsidizing some private individuals on state lands. And so do we do anything sort of analogous to this for when we're leasing to private individuals in that regard? Is there any type of market rate review that goes on for for instance, state lands, whether it's for forestry operations or grazing or, you know, whatever? Just a loaded question, but...
Chair Cromwell, Representative Dingfelder, yes. The Department of Administrative Services doesn't get involved in the state lands as land leases. We primarily are involved with office leases, and that's pretty much our involvement. However, when state lands was before the Public Lands Advisory Committee last month, they were describing their leasing program and indicated that they do appraisals, they do market, they do opinion of values, they get valuation on the property, they do comparables, and are in the market and generally check whether they're getting a good lease rate or not. They would have to speak though directly to alleviate your question of concerns about are they getting the top value, but from our indications that they said that they go through those processes.
Okay.
A little different.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I mean, it's something that we do through the Ways and Means process, but I also think it could be a function of the Audit Committee to have the agencies come and talk about what they're doing, similar to what, I mean, to me, I see this as a parallel issue of what we're looking at here today, and I think it's, again, we want to make sure that we're charging fair market value and realizing any savings we can, or making sure we're not overcharging private individuals.
I wrote myself a note here that maybe one of the things that we would want to do is maybe hear from the Public Lands Advisory Committee and some of the recommendations that they might have as far as property sales are concerned and that sort of thing and some of the activities that they're doing. So I will follow up with Jim on that and see when we might be able to put that into our schedule to hear from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Other questions? I have a few. First of all, on page 43, or the last slide that you had up, John, it shows that, for example, in the Veterans Affairs Building, the Health Licensing Office and the construction contractors and the Employment Department are paying it $1.50 a foot. I don't know if you can still bring that up or not. Yeah, there we go. Are paying $1.50 a foot. But in the State Lands Building, which is right across the street from there, the Employment Department is paying $1.31 a foot. And Econ Development is paying $1.31. And so that's... But then the real sweetheart deal is the Department of Education is only charging the Blind Commission 55 cents a foot. Can you help me understand what the differences are there? I mean, it certainly isn't because the Department of Education building is a Class C building, is it? Is it? I'm just kind of wondering why the in Division of State Lands Building, or I mean Department of State Lands Building, is or am I getting the Department of State Lands and Division of State Lands mixed up? They're one and the same,
they're
right?
One the same.
And that building is across the street from the Veterans Building, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I'm just making sure I'm in the right part of the mall.
We're in the right world. Chair Cromwell, let me try to answer that. Department of State Lands has had a policy of charging a rate on the Capitol Mall that's commensurate with the uniform rent rate that DAS charges in DAS' own building. Now, that's a decision that they have made on their own, as they could charge more, but they felt that, and I believe they feel that they'd like to be competitive and charge the rate that is other agencies are paying on other DAS' own buildings on the mall. So that's where you see the $1.31 rate. Departments of Veteran Affairs, which owns their own building, has the ability to charge more and has up until recently done that. And it was in the past year that Department of Administration, DAS, when we went in and looked at these leases, said that we weren't going to put state agencies on the mall in a rate higher than uniform rent rate. And so these rates for the groups that are in there have been capped and will not be increasing until uniform rent rate increases up there. So this was an inconsistency that we found in the leasing from other agencies on the mall. And so if we are asked at DAS to put a state agency in Veterans Affairs, it will be at a capped level. It will not be at $1.60 or $1.65, which they would have.
And is it capped at $1.50?
They're now capped at $1.50.
So how many bienniums do we guesstimate that it will take the uniform rent rate to catch up to that $1.50 rate?
I don't know.
Well, that's why I asked for a guesstimate. You know, it's just make a wag.
Mr. Chairman, depending on a number of circumstances, maybe two or three.
Okay. I'm going to go back to a couple of other, I didn't mark them, which I knew that I should have. On page three of your report, at the very bottom, it said that we provide private office leasing services to 60 agency boards and commissions accounting for 4 million square feet. Are those through private realtors, or are those through, or is that what?
I'm sorry, which page?
It's on page three of your. So when it says our role in facilities at the very top, and you were talking, and so it says that, you know, we provide, at the very bottom it says we provide private office leasing services to 60 states. Is that through private realtors that you're doing that, or is that through your staff? I'm trying to understand sort of the nomenclature there.
We provide a brokerage service for agencies where we place state agencies as tenants in privately owned space, and that's what that's referring to.
Okay. And then, if we go back to talking about the CPAB process at page 7, and one of the things that it says there about the middle of the page is that each even-numbered year agencies prepare and present to CPAB a facility plans on properties greater than $1 million. Is that going to be like new construction, or that they're new construction that they're planning, or remodeling that they're planning, or because it obviously wouldn't be maintenance, because B is maintenance. And so I'm just trying to make sure that I sort of am understanding and get my hands around.
Go ahead. All right. Mr. Chairman, that's really, it can be either, it's really looking at facilities that are worth more than $1 million. And that may mean that it's something that's being constructed that's more than $1 million, or that is something that's being renovated, that the value of that project on that building that's worth more than $1 million comes into play.
Okay.
So it's really trying to set a threshold of keeping out some of the smaller things, but getting at the buildings of value.
Okay, so that would be the value of the project, not necessarily the value of the building.
The part is 500. Yeah.
Well, go ahead, John. Try. The
facility, they present a plan on buildings that are of $1 million in replacement value or greater. And within that building, there may be projects, may be, as Bill indicated, a renovation or a remodel. Anything over $500,000 will come to this board to review, and there'll be a plan for it. But the plans are broader. The plans look at the agency's need. And these are the bodies that they have. And this is the facility solution on how they're going to accomplish housing those people and meeting their mission. And so it lays out what the big picture looks like, and then it drills down to specific projects within certain buildings that they're anticipating for the coming biennium. And that's where that
is. Okay. I think I understand.
I should indicate that it also addresses options that were considered.
Oh, okay.
So it's not just an agency wish list. They have to explain why this was the best option.
Okay. And then back at page 14, this is the slide that says summary findings to 2000 statewide facilities report. And at the bottom it says historically agency funding for the maintenance repair of state facilities is below what's needed. I'm trying to understand how this works with the budget request. So, let's say an agency goes in. Well, let's say ODOT, since that's kind of a hot topic on facilities.
So for their Capitol Mall building, they've gone in year after year, session after session to the legislature and said, we need X number of dollars of general fund for this and for office space, and we've got our other funds and yada, 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 and we need $1.3 million this year, or this biennium, for our building maintenance and to make sure that our, you know, elevators keep working and that our roof is not leaking and that our HVAC systems are up to date and yada, yada, yada. They go through all this stuff. So then, did the legislature, or would the legislature then say, well, we don't think you need $1.3 million, because, well, we're up here and we're wiser, and we think you only need a $900,000. So we're cutting $400,000 out of that request. Would that actually be what happens, or would it be a matter that the agency says, well, we need $1.3 million, and the legislature says, great, you know, go forth, fix your building, do good things. But then the agency says, you know what, maybe we ought to take this $400,000 and put it over here because we really need it over here. And, you know, this elevator will wait just a little bit longer, and it'll be all right. So how does that work? Because I'm really bothered by the fact that the statement is made, historically, agency funding for the maintenance and repair of state facilities is below what's needed. I'm really bothered by that. Because if it's us doing it, then shame on us, because we need to make sure that we keep our state facilities in good condition and up to code and all of that kind of stuff. If it's the agencies doing it, after they've told us one thing that they're going to do with the money and then turn around and do something else, then I'm really pissed. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think this is trying to reflect an overall trend and things, and I think what you're describing there probably all is true. You know, at different times, under different circumstances, it may have been the legislature. At other times, it may have been the agency themselves that made some of those decisions. But the ultimate result is that at the end of the day, we probably don't have the level of funding that needs. And it's different circumstances with different agencies. I mean, when we've talked with, like, the military department, they have kind of two inventories of buildings. One inventory, they get some of the funding from the federal government to do some of the maintenance and operations, and those buildings are in good shape. Then they have their armory program, and those buildings, they don't get anything other than state support, and it means, and that has not been at the level it needs. And over time, and I think that has been a legislative decision, and those buildings have been slowly deteriorating.
So the short answer is there's enough blame to go around to everyone, right?
Mr. Chair, I think that's probably true.
Okay. Let me see. I'm just quickly going through here because there's a couple of other things that I think I had. At page 24, it says this is DAS-owned facilities and service agreements. DAS provides facility support services at cost to tenants in other agency-owned buildings. So, like the where we were talking earlier about the veterans building for the, and so you provided those support services for the agencies.
Mr. Chair, we had done some support to veterans. They have elected to deal with that in a different way. The only thing that we're doing specifically for that building at this point is the landscaping around it. In contrast, state lands, we provide all the services for that building.
So my question on that is that by contract? So that's a contract between State Lands and DAS?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Did State Lands require DAS to bid on that and sort of open it up to a competitive bidding process, or is it sort of the, no, you're playing on our space, so we're the only ones that can bid?
Mr. Chairman, the arrangement between ourselves and State Lands had been kind of an understanding from the beginning of when they constructed that building. It has not been put out to bid per se, but we're providing it at their request. If at some day they would decide that some or all of the services they would rather procure in another way, obviously they have that latitude to do so because it is simply an agreement.
If that were to occur, where State Land said, we want to go to Bill's building service down here, have them provide all of these support services, and you said, yeah, okay, no problem, and so you're out of it, and maybe they had Bill's bid on it and so on, would the cost of facility support to other tenants that you're providing or other building owners that you're providing that service to go up?
Mr. Chairman, it depends on how we managed it and what kind of agreement. You know, if that could be managed over from one budget to the next, we could deal with it in a way that would not. If that's kind of midstream, there is the possibility that, it would have some adverse effects. And I think what we would attempt to do, if there was a desire to change, would be to figure out how the timing of it that would be done in a way that would not have those adverse consequences.
Okay, so State Lands says they came to you last, let's just as an example, they came to you last July, because that'd be a year's notice, or last June, because that'd be a year's notice, and said, we don't want you to do this anymore, we're gonna go to Bill's. So then when you're looking at all of the, and then there's got to be another building out there that you do the, or another agency that you do the, provide these same services for.
Well,
name one, right?
Mr. Chairman, another one is PERS.
Okay, PERS. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I hear you saying is that then there is a possibility that the cost of PERS would go up, or could go up, based on the loss of the contract with State Lands.
Mr. Chairman, this is some of the complexities of just how all of this fits together, where somehow we would have to deal with it into the pool of our costs, but the likelihood of PERS going up is very remote.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
Just one question about PERS. Doesn't PERS own its own building?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, yes. And that's where, as John had described, we have three kind of models. And the last model is these service agreements, and that is for agencies that own their own facilities.
And the service agreements would be to provide custodial and exterior repair.
Or, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, or whatever blend they want. In some cases, it may be just custodial services, and the agency deals with everything else.
Okay. In that regard, Mr. Chair, I assume that when we're doing the custodial and grounds work and so forth on those third types of buildings, that we're also using the QFRs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it depends. Some are provided with our staff. If we go out elsewhere, you're correct. The first line of an alternative to our own staff is using a QRF.
QRF being?
Qualified Rehabilitation Facility. I'm sorry, I overthink it now.
Yes, you do. At page 34, or slide 34, it talks about the full service leases as of October 2004 in, Salem and Portland and Eugene. How does that compare to the uniform rents? Or is that kind of equal to the uniform rents?
Mr. Chair, I think, and this was part of what we've tried to explain and what Mr. Studi had tried to explain, is some of these don't line up real well.
Okay.
And many of the private leases have varying levels of services and and are different qualities. And so, for the most part, what we have with uniform rent most of the buildings are probably what I would call, you know, a B-plus or an A-minus. And, but some of this inventory may be a lesser quality. And I think some of that is just indicative of the buildings on the mall have a certain presence and deserve a certain level of quality, and that's where a lot of the square footage is.
And that's where a lot of the footage is in the uniform rents also,
yes.
Right? As opposed to doing it as a full service lease or.
Mr. Chairman, I think you know the point Mr. Studi was also making is that some of that classification is a combination of both the quality of the building and the quality of the service.
Right. Right. Okay. And then. Okay. When we go back, when we go back to slide 40, the rent cost component comparison with private lease space, and then the next page of 41 is state owned space. A couple of things that I noted here. First of all, on slide 40, it says enhanced security under a triple net. It says that's an agency cost. So I assume that would be the agency putting in a security system and all of that kind of stuff that they can then, you know, tie to somebody that, you know, calls police if there's a break-in and all of that kind of stuff. But it says under the typical state private lease, it says NA, which I'm going to assume, I know you should never assume, but I'm going to assume that means not applicable. Or not available. One of the two. So I'm just curious as far as why that would not be applicable or available.
Mr. Chair, I think it's just that in our inventory, we generally have not had that as a service that has been requested or supplied for individual lease locations.
Okay. Same question then with contingency, and it says agency cost and then not applicable or available. Now, I'm wondering what that contingency is referring to, because I do know that one of the requirements that DAS has of the agencies is to keep, I believe it's either a 3-month or a 6-month agency reserve. Now that, and I don't know if that's all fund or if that's just in terms of their available funds for building lease and that sort of thing. So I'm just curious as far as what that means under the contingency there.
Mr. Chairman, I think the what you're referring to is a 60-day cash balance, and so that as a budget is built from one biennium to the next is part of how the whole model is constructed, but there isn't a specific line item that was built into it for contingency, as okay. opposed to some of the other methods where we actually did a calculation on contingency.
Okay. And then building operation support, same sort of thing as far as same like with in terms of the security, enhanced security, is that that's not something that normally is present in the state-owned buildings. The state private lease.
Mr. Chairman, I guess perhaps I'm not following. Are you talking about amongst the options within the state buildings or in the private buildings?
I'm still on page 40. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what this means. So, like in the enhanced security, it said that you said that it was not applicable because of this. That's normally something that's not in the typical state private lease.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think what this is really referring to is that within our uniform rent buildings,
yes,
part of the service we provide is having a day custodian.
Okay,
and that helps with various operational issues. Typically, that is not in a lease.
Okay. Okay. Great. And that's all I have for now. Now, I I did have some additional things from the report that that I had read last night, but I think rather than chewing up time here, and we're getting pretty much close to our end, I'll make sure that see if there are any other questions that the other half of my committee that is still here has. Okay. With regards to House Bill 2236, I think that this gives us some members. I think this gives us some excellent background information. There may be some changes that we might want to do with this bill. I know that the department sort of their stand is that it's probably not really necessary from your perspective, or that's kind of how you view the bill as being not really necessary.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to deal with the stated purpose as we understand it in the bill, we don't think it's necessary. Now, if you would wish to incorporate other elements in it, such as other agencies having a similar thing where they're providing it, then, you know, with modification, that may in fact make sense. But because of the presence of that statute that already requires us to report those rents, unless we're capturing something that isn't already covered, it doesn't seem as if there's a particular point.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your coming today. I appreciate all of the information that you have given to us. Chair will kind of figure out what we're going to do with 2236 from here. And if we have questions, we will be in touch. And I also will talk with Jim about the potential of scheduling the Public Lands Advisory Board to come in and talk to us about some of the issues that both of you have raised. Anyway, with that, I'm going to thank you again. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2236. And
another day.
Yeah. Yeah. But is that a note I should keep?
You bet.
Sure.
Or do you want to keep it?
No, I don't want to keep it.
I should keep it? Okay.
Take it home with you.
Now, why would I want to do that? Although you have written quite a... Quite an expose here on the back of a post-it note. Very good. It's like almost, you know, you could almost turn that into a 30-page report. Okay, well, with that, we're going to stand adjourned. Thank you.